213898, United States of America versus John Raphael. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Applegate, you may proceed for the appellant when you're ready.
May it please the court, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. The district judge abused his discretion in imposing an unreasonably low, effectively non-custodial sentence. The judge placed too little weight on the nature and circumstances of this bribery and obstruction offense, on the need for general deterrence in public corruption cases, and on the uncontroverted guidelines range. At the same time, the district judge placed too much weight on personal characteristics of the defendant that have little relevance in federal sentencing. The judgment should be reversed. First, the sentence does not embody a reasonable effort to account for the circumstances of the offense. Mr. Raphael was a longtime public official who accepted $144,000 in bribes to steer a multi-million dollar contract to the bribe mayor. In exchange for those bribe payments, he took multiple official acts, including providing critical inside information that was central to the process of this food and beverage contract bid. When investigators questioned the defendant about his relationship with the company, he obstructed justice. He told multiple false statements to investigators and provided them with a falsified and fraudulently altered copy of the contract between himself and the bidder.
So I care a lot about neutral principles and the idea that the neutral principle here at stake is, after Booker, district courts have a fair amount of discretion, significant discretion, to depart or vary from the guidelines evenly. So I've dissented in cases where I thought above guideline sentence, but the district court, even though I would not have imposed that sentence, I didn't view it as abuse of discretion under the significant discretion that they now have. And so I guess the way I think about these cases is, how would I have thought about this if he got, say, a 102-month sentence? So it's an above-guideline sentence, which is a kind of close to like a one-day sentence. And do you have thoughts on whether this is the right type of analogy? But what I struggle here, just generally speaking, to be honest, is there's not a lot of standards for us to determine when a district judge abuses the judge's discretion. So maybe you could comment on that.
Your Honor, we don't resist the abuse of discretion standard here. The challenge the Supreme Court has given to district judges and to this court is to balancing discretion for the district judge against avoiding unwarranted sentencing disparities against similar defendants. And one way to look at whether a judge has properly exercised his discretion is by looking at the explanation that the district judge gave. And here, the district judge simply did not justify this unreasonably low sentence. The focus was not on the relevant characteristics. The focus was on things of marginal sentencing relevance. So the court dwelled on, for example, support from the community and letters that the defendant had received, which is a relevant consideration to be sure, but one of marginal weight. In fact, community ties, family support are discouraged factors under the guidelines. The court brought up that the defendant's mother and brother had passed away, that the judge and the defendant had grown up in the same general area, and the judge knew the defendant and members of the family. That's what the bulk of the district judge's time was spent on. And then when we turn to the other 3553A factors, the district judge gave them the back of his hand. For example, in describing the crime here, the nature and circumstances of the offense, the district judge described the offense as boneheaded, suggesting it was more clumsy than calculated, and said that the obstruction of justice, which was not objected to, was, quote, more a perception thing. The judge paid some lip service to general deterrence, but did not, and said, for example, that general deterrence was the most important 3553A factor here, reasonableness argument that it's an inadequate explanation, but over and over in substantive reasonableness cases, this court has said that the district judge needs to justify large variances from the guidelines, whether those are upward or downward. The justification is simply not on the record. And it's hard even to hypothesize what the
Our cases distinguish between two types of justifications. One is just a generic policy disagreement with the guideline, or just a rogue type case where I don't agree with the crack cocaine disparity, I'm going to depart from that. And the other is individualized reasons why you're varying from the guidelines. Would you, in some respects, I suppose, relying on the defendant's age as a discouraged factor, that could be seen as a disagreement with the policy of the guidelines, but would you describe this as a general disagreement case or as more of an individualized variance because the district court thought that the defendant was outside the mind around the guidelines?
We view it as an individualized case, Your Honor. The judge did not state any disagreement either with 2C1.1, the guideline he was applying, or as to the criminal history category or any other part of the guidelines. In fact, the district judge hardly spoke about the guidelines. At the beginning, the judge calculated the guidelines range and then never mentioned the sentencing guidelines again, which is one reason we think this is a substantively unreasonable sentence, Your Honor.
Do you think that it would be? So suppose he said, I think white-collar crimes, so I just disagree with the general deterrence point. I think white-collar crimes are already punished too much, so I'm gonna vary for that reason. Would that come with the presumption of reasonableness? Do you think that could be described as what was going on here because he gave such short shrift to general deterrence?
I think two answers, Your Honor. One fact-specific and one a broader legal point. Here, the district judge specifically said the opposite, which is that he thought general deterrence was the most important factor. So I don't perceive that to be what the district judge did here. When district judges disagree with the guidelines, they can do that, but it's not given a presumption of reasonableness. It's looked at closely by this court in cases like Bistline and others. If the judge had done that and had justified his disagreement with the guidelines and why the sentence he imposed met the other 3553A factors, including, importantly, avoiding unwarranted sentencing disparities, it's certainly possible that a sentence could be upheld on those grounds. It's hard to see how this specific sentence could be upheld on those grounds, but certainly a downward variance may be justified, but that's simply not what the district judge did here. The judge would also, in that context, have to contend with the nature and circumstances of the offense, not just general deterrence as an abstract matter, but specifically why this sentence, which involved a quite large bribe payment and then obstruction afterwards, why a downward variance to this degree would be warranted under 3553A1. Your Honor brought up age of the defendant. Again, as Your Honor indicated, age is a discouraged factor, physical condition is a discouraged factor. In any event, Mr. Rayfield's age and physical condition were not so severe as to preclude prison time categorically. There was no request for a downward departure on those grounds. A downward departure was not granted, and the record would suggest that that was right. The PSR reported, and this was not objected to, that Mr. Rayfield worked and made substantial income before the charges. There's no evidence that he had any health complications from his prior imprisonment. The defendant represented that he was...
Well, counsel, I agree, there wasn't much of an explanation, but there was a lot of discussion of the offense, and I don't think it's your typical bribe case. I mean, that there was a plea, etc., but it's not a typical bribe case. He and the gravamen was giving the confidential information. other fact was that this happened before he then served time for another event, so that you were dealing with the defendant who had committed the offense before experiencing prison. And I believe both sides agreed that there was no chance of him reoffending, so that general deterrence became the one factor that was weighing in favor of a meaningful sentence. And that's not your typical bribe case, I don't think.
I see my time is up. May I respond?
Please.
Thank you. First, I would resist the idea that this was not a typical bribe case. It was an exchange of a substantial amount of money for official acts, here providing inside information. Your Honor mentioned that some of this may have been public. That's contrary to the record. In the statement of facts and in the unobjected to PSR, it said the inside information that Mr. Rayfield provided to the bribe payer was confidential at the time that he provided.
That's what I said. Some of it may have later become public.
Oh, I apologize. I misunderstood. At the time he provided it, it was confidential.
Yes, that's true.
And so, in that way, it was an entirely typical bribe case. The public official receives a thing of value, and he takes official acts in exchange for it. Official acts which provided assistance to the bribe payer. I also, although I agree that specific deterrence was not a significant factor at sentencing, I would resist the idea that general deterrence was the only relevant 3553A factor. It may have been the only species of deterrence that mattered at sentencing, but the nature and circumstances of the offense, the unobjected to guidelines range of 41 to 51 months, the personal characteristics of the defendant, and others were also 3553A factors that were very much at play in sentencing. It wasn't simply general deterrence, and our argument here is not simply that the court gave unreasonably little weight to general deterrence.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Roger Sugarman on behalf of defendant appellee John Rayfield. May it please the court. The district court properly considered all of the 3553A factors, balanced them, and imposed a sentence here that was sufficient but not greater than necessary to comply with the purposes of sentencing. Judge Watson's exercise of his post-Booker sentencing discretion to deviate downward from the low end of the guidelines to arrive at this sentence should be affirmed by this court for many of the reasons that Your Honors expressed during questioning of government's counsel. The court's sentence reflects its reasoned discretion and is substantively reasonable. Contrary to the government's focus on simply two of the 3553A factors, the court did in fact, as the record displays.
The court said nothing about why, in spite of certain factors, it was appropriate. The court recognizes the problem with general deterrence, the problem of breach of trust, and then doesn't address why the sentence reflects that.
Your Honor, if there is a weakness in the opinion, it perhaps is brevity as opposed to expounding upon all the various reasons for reaching the conclusions that it did and the sentence that it imposed. Your Honors know from Supreme Court cases, Reader versus the United States, for example, being foremost, whether the appropriateness of brevity or length, conciseness, or detail, when to write, what to say, depends upon the circumstances.
Don't you think the circumstances here, going from a 41 to 51 month guideline sentence down to one day, maybe a little more than brevity was at issue? I completely agree with the idea that it can be brief, but it is a pretty significant variance downward.
It is a significant variance.
So our cases post
considerable amount of time on the addressing the need to avoid unwarranted sentencing disparities at the sentencing record at page 209. He went through the, for example, the 240 cases sentencing commission data with respect to bribery and corruption. He looked at those cases. In approximately 45% of those cases, prison was not imposed on the defendants as part of the sentence. So I think while it's not as direct as Your Honors may wish it to have been, Judge Watson thoroughly considered what the deterrent factor in the sense of avoiding unwarranted sentencing disparities in looking at the specific deterrence with respect to this particular individualized defendant. I think he did not overlook the fact, and as the Gall versus United States Supreme Court decision says, there is to be accorded substantial weight, which I don't believe the government gives in this case, to the substantial restriction of freedom involved in a term of supervised release, which the Supreme Court has recognized. So that's part of the general deterrence. The specific deterrence, of course, has already been addressed. But this defendant was sentenced to 3 years of supervised release with 18 months of location monitoring, home confinement at his location monitoring, $144,000 in forfeiture, a $28,251 sentence of restitution. So I think the composite, Your Honors, as opposed to the court detailing and necessarily going through each one of the factors in order, it is part and parcel of the transcript, though, and the time he spent before imposing sentence. So is it for us to say how it could or should have been written as opposed to looking at the discretion that the court exercised in considering the totality of the circumstances? He considered the totality of the 3553A factors, not simply the nature and circumstances of the offense. That is one of the factors to be balanced in the same sentence as subsection A1 as the personal characteristics of the defendant, which is to be given more weight. The guidelines are imprecise at best at that. But if you go through the need for the sentence imposed under 3553A2, I believe the court met all of those particular factors, all of those standards. And when viewed in the context of, as Your Honors noted, the discretion that is afforded the district court, who looks at and has the experience in both sentencing and in this particular case, the experience with this particular defendant. It's the second time in which this defendant appeared before His Honor, and he made that clear in the context of this sentencing, and he had a grasp of both what had happened in this case, what had happened in the prior case. He took into account not the related case of the U.S. versus Myers, but he certainly had that as part of his litany of assessments in making this particular sentence. And then he looked at the national figures from the U.S. Sentencing Commission, which I mentioned and which are clearly in the red.
Because those were somewhat in the abstract. I mean, the usual way we think about unwarranted sentencing disparities is the expert commission is the one that sets the guidelines, and the guidelines are the average sentence for this type of crime. So I would think that there is a pretty significant risk of a sentencing disparity here, given that the departure is so broad. Why should we look to those statistics rather dealt with pretty significant downward variances of this nature, like from a guidelines range in the 30 to 60 month range down to 1 day. And I have to say, the vast majority of opinions that I have read have reversed these types of pretty significant downward variances. So that suggests to me, at least, that we should be looking at this sentence pretty closely. Would you concede that most decisions that you've reviewed have reversed, or how would you address circuit precedent in the analogous scenario?
Certainly. I tried in the brief on the cases that were cited by the government, especially in the child pornography cases, which is where you get into the policy disagreements with the sentencing guidelines. I think that's where you see, in those cases where there was a significant downward variance downward, is where this court reversed the Blissline case, the Robinson cases, the Camacion case. Those were cases in which the court did say that this policy disagreement, which formed the basis for the sentence in the district court, was inappropriate and was reversed. In the same set of circumstances, Judge, there's the Dima case that's cited in the briefs that came out of this circuit as well, in which the court affirmed a one-day sentence of imprisonment. So I can't say that I'll agree in the vast majority of the cases which relate to child pornography, where the sentence reflects a significant disagreement by the district court judge leading to that downward variant, that the cases were reversed. I did not find them necessarily in this case. I found some additional cases after I saw this panel, and I know Judge White has authored an opinion in which a one-day sentence was affirmed by this court. I believe it was Prisel, P-R-I-S-E-L, and I looked at other cases in which Your Honor and Judge Batchelder were involved, and there's both results occur. So I will concede that it becomes more of a head scratcher for Your Honors to look at a district court decision where you wish there was more from the district court judge in explaining the decision. I don't disagree.
What would be wrong with saying that remanding for a resentencing and saying not necessarily that we're overturning the sentence, but that it hasn't been justified on the record that has been presented to us?
I hope Your Honors do not do that, obviously. I think there's sufficient need in the record that Your Honors can see the discretion of the court exercised, and that I appreciate that you're not going to undertake a de novo review of that, but I think there is sufficient evidence and sufficient recounting by the district court judge that would allow an affirmance. I'm not so naive to not believe that that was something that Your Honor suggested that was a possibility. I think that much more so than a substantive unreasonableness and waiting. But, Your Honors, you know that Judge Watson is a very deliberate, thorough, thoughtful judge. He does not undertake his assignment lightly, and he gave great consideration and deliberation to the sentence. And I would think that on all the bases that he articulated in his opinion, albeit not as thorough as perhaps this court or others might wish, that it can be affirmed under the standards of Gaul, it can be affirmed under the standards that this court has adopted since Gaul, and without having to remand for further explanation of the reasons under 3553C.
Counsel, I was curious about something. In the written agreement, there's a statement of facts, and included in that is the statement that very quickly after, or very soon after, the contract was awarded, your client sent a bill to his client for a success fee. And that, I think, was in the agreed-upon statement. Then, at sentencing,
pled guilty. He did, in fact, send the invoice that Your Honor had mentioned. He did send it for the amount of the money that was in the contract. And there's no disputing that.
So that is fact. That was established.
It's fact.
That he did send that contract.
Correct.
Sorry.
He did send the invoice for the successor judge. No disputing that. My time's up. I appreciate your attention. Thank you.
I'd like to address two points in my remaining time. The first is about brevity and the brevity of the court's explanation. Judge Murphy, you mentioned the case United States versus Rene Boucher from just a few years ago. In that case, this court repeatedly talked about the importance of an explanation in a substantive reasonableness challenge for multiple of the 3553A factors in saying that the variance needs to be justified and explained in light of the nature and circumstances of that offense, in light of the need for general deterrence, in light of the need to avoid unwarranted sentencing disparities and the guidelines. There, the guidelines range was 21 to 27 months, and the sentence was 30 days, so the variance there was smaller than the variance here, and the explanation here is no better. The judge did not explain why an effectively non-custodial sentence was warranted in light of the nature and circumstances, the need for general deterrence, the need to avoid unwarranted sentencing disparities. Boucher is in a long line of cases, really starting with Gall, but going to Musgrave, which explained that the larger the variance, the better the explanation needs to be. And Musgrave also said that an explanation of how a non-custodial sentence affords general deterrence is particularly important, especially in light of the size of the variance there. Here, the brevity of the district judge's explanation is not just its weakness, it's its fatal reversible weakness. It simply didn't put enough on the record to explain why the sentence here is justified under the 3553A.
Can I ask just briefly about the use of the Sentencing Commission statistics?
Yes.
That's been, I've seen that happen more often when there's an upward variance and defendants have been criticizing the statistics as, you know, maybe over-inclusive, under-inclusive. It's very difficult to tell with abstract statistics alone where the individual defendant would fit. Do you have any comments on the use of the statistics here, and were they an appropriate benchmark apart from the guidelines range, maybe to think about unwarranted citizen disparities?
I'll answer both generally the use of statistics and specifically the use here. Generally, the use of the commission sentencing statistics is appropriate and has been blessed by this court. The use here was not an appropriate use, and that's because really the court was looking at the wrong set of statistics. The court used statistics that in 2C1.1 cases, so roughly speaking, bribery and extortion cases. And the court grouped them, used statistics that grouped sentences under that guideline into imprisonment, probation only, and mixed sentences. But the statistics that the court used did not divide any more than use of that guideline. So whether that was a $1 bribe for a minor matter or $1 million bribe for a major matter, the statistics did not discern. The Sentencing Commission does have statistics that get into more granular detail. In fact, I believe in the Boucher case, the court cited specific statistics saying someone under the assault guideline with offense level 17 or whatever it was there and criminal history category 1, this is the range of sentences that people receive. That's a more appropriate use.
Is there anything like that in the record here?
Nothing like that in the record whatsoever.
Is it conceivable? Do you know if we went to the Sentencing Commission's website and tried to figure it out? I mean, it's a difficult website to maneuver. So, I mean, most of the time, that's the response when people don't like the use of statistics, is they say that, well, these statistics are misleading for these reasons. They're over-inclusive and under-inclusive. I've not really seen a case where they actually were spot on.
I don't know. I've not looked on the Sentencing Commission's website to see if the specific kinds of statistics that were cited in Boucher are available here. I would assume that they are, but I just don't know that for sure. It's not in the
Is it fair to say that you are at least as concerned here about the district court's focus on his own knowledge of this defendant and the fact that this defendant had, you know, already suffered a lot?
I see that my time is up. May I respond? We are not pressing a procedural reasonableness challenge, which is to say we are not arguing that the court relied on improper considerations. That's not an argument we're pressing here. We are saying, however, that the personal characteristics, including things like the effect of his prior sentence,